Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Safe, and we are joined in our D.C. studio by Governor Bill Weld. Thank you for coming back. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
I think this is your third appearance on the Bulwark Podcast. I believe we were there at the foundation. We were there at the beginning.
I'm honored.
So how is it going for you? How is it going? What kind of what are you hearing from folks up in New Hampshire these days?
New Hampshire is moving. I noticed beginning in August that more people were coming up to me in the street saying, "Hi, Governor," than I was buttonholing. And that was something new. And the president did not have a great August. And then he really didn't have a good September. And that got even more pronounced. And the October poll came out showing that his standing in the head-to-head had gone down 17 points in the month of September, and mine had gone up 11 points. You know, still a huge, huge gap, but he can't have too many more months like that, or I'll be doing better than Pat Buchanan did.
Well, and of course, that's the big test, and Republicans really do need to ask themselves, you know, whether they really want five more years of this. They want five more years of having to defend this president, and as you point out, the last several weeks have not been good. So let's talk about impeachment and where we're at on impeachment. A couple of developments over the last 48 hours, including Lindsey Graham, desperate to show the White House that he is still a loyalist. So he put together a resolution condemning the House procedures. And interestingly enough, only got 44 sponsors. Now, I don't know how much to read into this, how much you read into the fact that you have, I think it's nine Republicans who were not willing to sign on, which would indicate at least, if not a crack, then a hairline fracture in Republicans in the Republican Senate wall defending Trump.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, I don't think there's more than four, at most five votes for removal in the Senate right now. But, you know, there comes a time in politics when the unthinkable becomes the inevitable. And you see that in all kinds of contexts, how public opinion, having been sluggish for a long time, can move quickly. In a completely unrelated area, I think of public support for gay marriage, which was nowheresville for a long time. And then suddenly it just kind of took off and became, you know, the lay of the land. It got into the water table. And, you know, I saw it on the Nixon impeachment where it went in one day when the tapes became public showing that Mr. Nixon had been well aware of the Watergate cover-up conspiracy as opposed to unaware, as he had maintained. Barry Goldwater went to see him the next day and said, "You now have zero votes in the Senate. You had 46 yesterday. You have zero today." He went with Carl Curtis, who was the most conservative man in the Senate. And Nixon, you know, almost asked for the pen. He was gone within a couple of weeks.
So where are you coming down on this? I know that there are two other Republican challengers, and they seem to be, Mark Sanford seems much more skeptical of impeachment. Where are you coming down? What do you think that the Senate ought to do now?
I think the Senate must vote to remove the president. I think that the country cannot afford five more years of Donald Trump. He's a reckless, out-of-control person who's threatening civil war, whose lawyers are arguing with a straight face in court that he can commit murder and not even be investigated as long as he's president. So someone's giving him that legal advice. I certainly hope it's not my friend Bill Barr, but somebody is, and he's taking it, and, you know, he's taking on more and more of the trappings of an absolute dictator. I can do anything I want, and nobody can stop me. And, you know, there's a lot of bad things that could happen if he's not removed, if we have, you know, five more years of Trump. The Republicans will lose the Senate in 2020. Bingo. So anyone who's faintly right of center, even on fiscal matters, who's worried about, you know, things being too far left, if the Democrats win, I mean, they can kiss the Senate goodbye. And it makes a huge difference. I was in Washington in the 80s under Reagan when we lost the Senate. We, the Republicans, lost the Senate. And you go from a position of being able to call all the shots to not even being able to schedule a hearing. And you know who knows that? Leader McConnell knows that. So I would hope that as leader of his caucus, that, you know, he might consider just having a straw poll to see what people think. And if a straw poll is pushing pieces of paper across the table, no questions asked, only the leader looks at them, nothing is signed, that's the equivalent of a secret ballot. And you know that former Senator Flake of Arizona has said if there were a secret ballot as opposed to a public roll call in the Senate, you know, he says there would be 35 votes to remove. So that's really the question. When does that begin to move? Right now, the polling that I've seen says that 51% of the people in the country, all in, are in favor of removal. And if that 51% figure gets to 60%, I got to think those senators got to sit up and take notice of that.
Okay, but in fairness, let's imagine the scenario in which the Senate Republicans break with President Trump and actually remove him from office for the first time in American history. It would certainly be, you know, seems likely to me that would result in their loss of the Senate anyway. That something like that Republicans will pay a price at the polls in 2020. That the real consideration perhaps ought to be the longer term of what happens if you have a Republican Party that sticks with Donald Trump. I mean, I've thought about this, and now you live through Watergate and watched it very, very closely. Imagine an alternative history in which Republicans in Congress stood with Richard Nixon after the smoking gun came out. What would the consequences for the Republican Party have been then? Would Ronald Reagan ever have been elected president? So well, it's not just next year, it's for the next decade.
I understand. The Republicans would have been obliterated instantly. And indeed, the people who went through the draining exercise of supporting Mr. Nixon all summer long, saying there's not enough evidence, by and large, they lost their seats quite decisively in the midterms there, the 1974 election, which was a disaster for Republicans. And, you know, I think if the Republicans in the Senate did vote to remove, I think the country would heave a huge sigh of relief. You know, I go around the country, nobody wants to hear about Mr. Trump. They've internalized all his inanity and his insanity, and they don't like thinking about it. What's the number one issue on their minds? Health care. What's the number two issue on their minds? The deficit and the economy. You know, they're thinking about things that hit them in their pocketbook and hit them at home. It's not that they don't watch television. It's not that they aren't trying to get by with less than 6 hours a day of news from Mr. Trump. But, Lyndon Johnson once said, not someone I was ever close to at all, but he said, once you forfeit the trust of the American people, you'll never get it back as president. I do think that's true, and I think air is seeping out of the trust balloon with Mr. Trump. You know, the people that came my way in New Hampshire last month, those were independents. They were people in the middle. They weren't diehard Trump voters at all. But my sense is that the temper of the great middle of the country, people who are not rabid partisans in either direction, that temper has been sorely tested by the president's antics, and I think it's pretty close to breaking.
On impeachment, what grounds would you recommend that the House adopt? Broad grounds, narrow grounds, and then we'll talk about the evidence. But what are the grounds for impeaching and removing the president right now?
Ground number one would be the Ukraine shakedown, which is a combination of inviting, encouraging, demanding, directing foreign interference, not only in our affairs, but in a presidential election in which the president doing that was an interested party, combination of that with corruption of office, trying to abuse your office for personal gain. Those are the two things that the framers of the Constitution who wrote the impeachment and removal clauses were most concerned about: foreign interference and abuse of office for private gain. And Mr. Trump doesn't make any pretense that he isn't doing those things. You know, Mick Mulvaney says it's business as usual. Get over it. And Mr. Trump does not try to conceal that he wants to use his office to enrich the Trump Organization and himself and his family. He's right up on top of the table about it. That doesn't mean it's any less serious from a constitutional point of view. So that's one. Two would be the 10 instances of obstruction of justice, criminal obstruction of justice, in Volume 2 of Bob Mueller's report, in which the president directed people to file false documents and to lie. Four people, all of whom said, I can't do that. That would be a false document. That's a crime. I can't lie to Congress. That would be a crime. I can't do it. It wouldn't be true. It would be a lie. To all four of which people, the president said, what's your point? So what if it's a lie? So what if it's a false document? Don't you understand our job is to circle the wagons and watch out for my political skirts? That's essentially what he said to Jim Comey when he was, quote, interviewing him, close quote, for the FBI job. He wasn't interviewing him. He was just trying to see how far he could push Comey in the direction of blind, unquestioning political loyalty. And fortunately, Mr. Comey stood up to him. But I'm a bad person to ask in a way, Charlie, because I spent 7 years trying to keep politics out of the Justice Department and resigned when I saw that things were slipping away there. But I would recommend to the House those two articles. And, you know, after that, I mean, there's a cornucopia there. Put in a few more. I've read the transcript of every impeachment proceeding that we've had in the United States. And I will tell you that often there's a catch-all article, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5 is the previous four articles. And there's been more than one case where the first four articles of impeachment failed and the president, or not the president, but the judge usually was convicted on the catch-all article. So, but that's for the House, obviously.
Is there enough evidence now on the record that that we have heard of to push those impeachment indictments?
Yes, those are undisputed. Yeah. The facts in those two, the most alarming two instances that I can think of off the top of my head, the facts are undisputed.
This is what's remarkable about this, is that we usually wait for, you have an accumulation of evidence, and then you get a smoking gun. We've had the smoking gun in the beginning. We already have the tapes. We already have the transcript, the quote-unquote tapes. We already have the stained blue dress. The question is, what more do you possibly need? Although it's certainly possible that there are more smoking guns out there. And you sort of wonder, you know, this calculation, we started off by talking about the political calculation of Republicans in the Senate. I mean, I think that they not only have to be concerned about the short-term politics, but the long-term legacy, but also the ordeal that is heading their way, the what they are going to have to do, the contortions that they're going to have to, you know, put themselves into, the talking points they're going to have to advance. And you're seeing this week, you know, how much Trump and Trump world is demanding of them. The fact that they're beating up on Lindsey Graham to show more loyalty. Lou Dobbs is out there on Fox News essentially saying that you know, if Mitch McConnell had any backbone, if he had any testosterone, he would refuse to even hold a trial. So any attempt by Senate Republicans to have a, you know, thoughtful, middle of the road, reasonable sifting and winnowing of the facts is not going to be apparently sufficient for Trump world. And they are really trapped at the moment, aren't they? They are really trapped between the absolutist Trumpists and doing their constitutional duty.
They're not trapped at all. They got the key to the jailhouse door right in their pocket. And, you know, it occurs to me that the sigh of relief that the country would heave if Mr. Trump were removed from the scene, it would be just marvelous. And people would say, now I can go about my business. And it's not that it would be a bad precedent. It's not that there is an overwhelming evidence of the most serious conduct in office that any of the framers could possibly have imagined. I mean, I don't think they really thought it would ever come to this. But if we don't do that now, that's a very bad precedent. And if we do that, that's a valuable precedent. The next time some two-bit tin horn would-be dictator comes along and says, I can do anything I want, the answer would be, no, you can't. There are guardrails here for executive behavior. Look at the Trump case. That'd be a very handy precedent to be able to point back to.
Now, you mentioned the Department of Justice a couple of minutes ago. The latest development, of course, is the word that the Bill Barr has apparently shifted this investigation of the Department of Justice to a criminal investigation, that they are going after the folks who investigated the Russia collusion issue. It's a remarkable moment because, of course, you know, President Trump has made no secret of the fact that he wants to lock up his political opponents, wants investigations. And apparently, if you can't get Ukraine to go along, you can at least get Bill Barr. So give me your sense of, you know, you said you resigned from the Department of Justice because you were concerned that it was being politicized. Could you ever have imagined we'd be at this moment, this extent of politicization?
No, I can't. And I find this latest development most sinister. I would call it opening an investigation. I wouldn't call it spying. But again, Mr. Barr made no secret of his take on this. Within days of joining the department, he said, oh, I don't know. I think spying is pretty serious business. There was no spying. There was an opening of an investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and that's what they're in business to do. And boy, did they have plenty of predication for that.
Yeah, and I also don't want to pass over the other moment that you referred to, where you have the president's lawyers, his spokesman, going in front of a federal judge and explicitly arguing that if the president of the United States shot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, killed somebody, that he not only could not be charged, but he couldn't be investigated.
And they're beyond the example of shooting someone on Fifth Avenue. Now they're at murder.
Yes.
I think the judge asked him, if the president murdered someone, are you saying he could not be prosecuted or even investigated? And they said, yes, that's the position, Your Honor. It's breathtaking. It's breathtaking.
I'm trying to think of any historical parallels, after the divine right of kings. And this was something that I think even the British litigated before the American Revolution. The kings should not be able to kill somebody with impunity without being subject to the rule of law.
Yeah, no, there's no precedence in this country. And in England, you're right. It goes all the way back to 1215 and Runnymede, the struggle between the nobles and the king.
But we have to
and
fight
they were
these...
well rid of that by the American Revolution.
Yeah, well, apparently we have to fight these battles occasionally. Okay, the other story, and things move so quickly, your thoughts about the president choosing Doral, his own golf club, for the G7 summit, and then backing off from it?
Well, he made no bones about it. He was doing it. He thought it was great. It would help him help his property financially. In other words, he's pleading guilty. The facts are undisputed. And it's just that, after a while, the heat gets so hot that people say, oh, well, we're going to reverse on that. We're actually not going to leave Syria. We're not going to do the Doral. We're not going to do this. We're not going to do that. It doesn't take away from the fact that the president's impulses, the president's instincts, and the president's actions are illegal, and they're not consistent with his responsibilities under the Constitution. You know, in a way, President Nixon was removed or forced to resign for failure to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, because he didn't properly supervise the Watergate investigation. Mr. Trump is so far beyond merely failing to take care that the laws be executed. He's going against the laws, against the Constitution, and making no bones about it. And, you know, he's trying to do a 1933 beer hall putsch right now, and my hope is that he's overplayed his hand too early. But if we sit still for this, we're going to reap the whirlwind, and we'll deserve it.
Okay, his decision on Syria, he held a press conference yesterday earlier this week, where he announced that he was lifting all the sanctions on Turkey and suggesting that his policy was a complete success, and the Kurds were absolutely delighted by it. Your take?
He's just that's a word salad. You know, he rolled over and caved for Erdogan at the first sign of rain. In the first conversation, he tried to say, well, you know, we got these friends, the Kurds, and Erdogan said, no, not a bit of it. I won't hear of it. And the president rolled right over. I mean, he shows, after his initial art of the deal, unreasonable position, he caves with great regularity. He's on the wrong side of things on both sides of the football, both with his unreasonable opening and then his quickly caving.
What was extraordinary was the fact that he's blinking and then is now trying to gaslight us that he did not, in fact, blink. But this feels like an old question, but it seems, equally urgent now, that this week you had Erdogan making a deal with Vladimir Putin. Russia's footprint in Syria now has expanded. you think about the success that Putin has had just in a very short period of time in influencing American public policy and pushing us out of roles of leadership around the world. What is Donald Trump's fascination with authoritarian dictators like Vladimir Putin? What do you think is going on here?
Well, that's a question about the inside of Donald Trump's head, where I think fear and hatred dominate. I also think it's pretty clear that since Vladimir Putin thinks that the boundaries of Russia should be coincident with the boundaries of the former Soviet Union, that's good enough for Donald Trump, who's in the Oval Office with Ambassador Kislyak and Foreign Minister Lavrov, and the only press that are allowed in there are TASS from Moscow, the state organ, press organ of Russia. And he couldn't be clearer about it. And I will say I fear for Eastern Europe and the Baltics with Mr. Trump in office, because he's going to hand them after Syria off to Vladimir Putin. And I don't know what the fascination is, other than that it's knowledge at some level. I'm weak. I want to be a strong man. I don't know. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I can recognize illegal and unconstitutional action.
Okay, well, let's talk about human scum and what happens next. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with Governor Bill Weld, who is challenging Donald Trump in the Republican primaries to the extent that there are Republican primaries. What is, by the way, is the status of Republicans canceling primaries? The RNC being so confident in Donald Trump that they don't even want Republicans to be able to vote for you, Mark Sanford, or Joe Walsh.
Well, anyone who's speaking for Donald Trump is lying. So these Republican state parties say, well, there's precedent for pulling the primary when we have a president running for re-election without opposition. This president has two-term Republican governors running against him. Okay, so that's justification number one. Justification number two, we want to cancel the election to save money. Well, that kind of proves a lot. We should cancel all our elections, which are the lifeblood of our democracy, in order to save money. Not so sure about that. But anyway, they've already been sued in court for canceling these elections, and so they're going to spend the money anyway. So as usual, there's no truth on the other side, and I'm sad about that. I'm rueful about that. But you know, when someone's part of the Trump vertical, they lie for a living. I'm so sorry to have to say that.
The president put out a tweet the other day, lashing out at Never Trumpers as being as human scum was his phrase. He said that there are so few of them, they're on life support, but they are perhaps even more dangerous than the do nothing Democrats. Any thoughts on being described as human scum by the president of the United States?
Yeah, no, I think Governor Sanford and Representative Walsh and I were included in human scum. I thought, you know, at least we're human. You know, I thought the president pulled his punch in a way. And he could have gone a lot further, but it's just a sign of the general weakness that I've been describing.
Okay, so this is difficult, but since we're talking about the removal of the President of the United States, you know, either through impeachment or through his defeat for renomination or his defeat in the general election, The hardest question that I get from people is, what is the future of the Republican Party? What does the conservative movement look like? How long will it take to shake off the stain of Donald Trump? So what do you think? How long is it going to take? Will people immediately begin to wipe the stain off? Will they be able to move on to the issues that you're talking about, American exceptionalism, small government, limited government, fiscal responsibility? Is it going to take a generation? Is it going to take a few years? What's your take?
It all depends on what the Republicans in the Senate do right now. If they remove Trump, the country will heave a sigh of relief, and it'll be within months like it never happened. And it's like after a hated newspaper editor leaves the paper, people come out of their offices and say, "Is it safe to come out now? My goodness." This is so great. You mean we don't have to truckle under to this and pretend that? So I think it would pass rapidly. People say, was that a bad dream? Did that actually happen? Or did we live through that? And if the Republicans don't do that, and we wind up with, let's say Trump puts $2 billion into Facebook ads and wins the election, so we have five more years of Donald Trump. No, because Donald Trump doesn't care about the Republican Party. He wants them to walk the plank for him, but he doesn't care about them at all. So the party will blow up if that happens, and it'll be a very unappealing mess.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of the lesson of Nixon and Watergate, isn't it, though? I mean, they did pay a price in 1974 and, of course, lost the presidency in 1976. But by 1980, whose career was really, by 1980, the whole Nixon shadow seemed to have been forgotten. And of course, things move much faster.
That's right. And it's because he was removed. It's because he had the grace to resign.
Donald Trump will never have the grace to resign, though, will he?
I think that's a fair statement.
So
I'll tell you, though, if he would hire me instead of Rudy Giuliani as his personal lawyer,
yeah, how would that work?
I could get him everything but the Congressional Medal of Honor in an exit scenario. I could get him flyovers, medals, tanks, carte blanche to burnish
parade.
His brand,
yeah.
Many parades. But he could work with and for the benefit of his family. And having duly elected president of the United States, he could found a news empire that would swallow up and dwarf Fox News. That would be alongside a whole new line of offerings besides hotels. He'd have a wonderful life. He'd be doing the things he loves to do. I don't know why he wants to continue in his present position. He really doesn't seem to be enjoying it, and he's taking a lot of flack for it. He also could solve all this with a snap of his fingers and a stroke of his pen.
So here's the deal. What if he would agree to, if you just put the Trump logo in gold, Trump, vertically on the side of the Washington Monument in return for his immediate departure? Would you go with that?
Yeah, no, I'd go for that in a heartbeat. There was an old New Yorker cartoon when he'd had a good year, and there was a husband and wife looking up at the harvest moon, and on the harvest moon was written, "The Trump, formerly the moon." And the husband is saying to his wife, "Man, is that guy having a good year?" Well, we could make that year look like just nothing compared to what the future could hold for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, going back to impeachment, it does seem that Republicans have settled in. Their strategy right now is to talk about the process rather than the substance, for obvious reasons. I think every lawyer understands this. One of our friends, Matt Lewis, over at the Daily Beast says the House Republicans, though, are turning themselves into the O.J. Simpson jury. But are you comfortable with the way Democrats are handling the process right now in the House of Representatives?
Well, I do remember from the Nixon impeachment that the Republicans got to attend all the hearings and cross-examine the witnesses. My understanding is that that's true now for the members of the House committee hearing the impeachment inquiry and collecting evidence, and that there are other Republicans who want to be in. That didn't happen in 1974. There weren't other people who were not members of the Judiciary Committee who demanded to come in and listen to the tapes, et cetera. So I think that's without precedent.
So let's talk about your campaign a little bit. You know, you and I talked, I'm not even sure whether you'd even announced. It was very, very early, very, very early on, and it seemed just the longest of the long shots. It still is. But are you getting a different reaction? Are you hearing, what are you hearing differently? What are you hearing that is different from Republicans in the last, say, 4 to 6 weeks than you might have heard when you were first launching this campaign?
Oh, I'm welcome everywhere now, and you know, I'm talking to the whole country. I'm certainly not talking only to Trump Republicans. I don't think that'd be very productive. I think a lot of those people are you know, immovably convinced that the president is the best thing that ever happened, and you know, they're not all crazy. I thought "Drain the Swamp" was a very peppy slogan. Anti-bureaucracy. I'm not politically correct. I thought Donald Trump as the candidate was the best of the bunch in several of those Republican debates when there were 12 people on the stage. He seemed to have the courage of his convictions, and he seemed at that moment to be very comfortable in his own skin, which is a long suit of mine. I don't think he seems that way anymore. But I'm not saying a vote for Trump in 2016 was a crazy vote. On the other hand, I am trying to talk to the whole country. I think the President of the United States has a duty to take care for everybody, not just to take care that the laws be executed. So I'm talking to independents and Democrats as well as to Republicans. And I sense a groundswell, and I may have shared this with you before, but I'm looking hard at the 20 states that allow crossover voting, where independents and Democrats can vote in the Republican primary. It's not a closed primary. And that includes New Hampshire, of course. And part of the plan is to either win or place high in New Hampshire. And then right after that comes Super Tuesday on March 3rd, which has Massachusetts, Vermont, Wisconsin, California, Virginia, a whole bunch of very interesting states, all of which I intend to contest vigorously. In California and New York, which I also intend to contest vigorously, that's a lot of votes. So, you know, the plan is start with the six New England states, then the Mid-Atlantic states, then swing west to friendly territory, which is California, Oregon, Washington, some of the western states where I spent a lot of time in the last cycle. That would include Colorado and New Mexico. And then the end would be the Rust Belt states that everyone says are going to be decisive in the final here, and that would be Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So the map is clear enough.
So the obvious question, though, is, you know, will you have enough money to do this? One of the stories of the Trump takeover of the Republican Party has been the acquiescence of the donor class in supporting Donald Trump. Are you seeing any cracks there? Are you going to be able to raise enough money from Republican donors to run that kind of a campaign?
Well, they wouldn't be just Republican donors. You know, we've got a super PAC, and Democrats come in under the super PAC. They don't mind standing up and being counted. And we also have a nonprofit that's anonymous donors, and Republicans tend to go there. I would say that everybody is being more open these days. For the record, I don't cooperate with those, not allowed legally to cooperate with those big fundraising operations up in the sky. No, you don't need that much money to be competitive in New England, maybe a few million dollars in New Hampshire, and social digital fundraising is much more important now than the old-fashioned kind. But no, the welcome is there, and it's getting bigger. So we'll have plenty of money to do what we need to do. Now, if everything doesn't work, then fundraising can dry up. But we're not going to know that until at least after Super Tuesday.
You mentioned that you were hearing people who were talking about healthcare, and who were talking about the deficit and the debt. And of course, this has been one of the ironies of a Republican Party run by Donald Trump that has run up $1 trillion a year deficits, but the Democrats seem to be vying with one another who can spend more money. And I'm looking at a report here from Yahoo Finance that tallied up all of Elizabeth Warren's plans, and they come to $4.2 trillion a year. So give me your sense of what's happening on the Democratic side, and whether or not that is getting people, you know, focusing. You know, I mean, are you concerned that the Democrats may nominate somebody outside of the mainstream and may facilitate a second term for Donald Trump?
Oh, very much concerned about that. But whether or not it's a Warren or a Sanders, all of the Democrats, I think, are making the same mistake, which is to boast about how much money they're going to spend on each and be judged by that yardstick on each issue. For example, on the climate change issue, all of them are saying, I'm going to spend $16.3 trillion. That's Sanders. Mm-hmm. And poor Joe Biden bringing up the rear with $1.6 trillion. And that seems to be the coin of the realm. How much are you going to spend? Not, are you going to put a price on carbon so there will be less carbon in the atmosphere so the temperature of the Earth's atmosphere will not rise by more than 1.5 degrees centigrade by 2050, which is the only scientific question you have to ask. There's no discussion of that in the Democratic plans. All there is how many trillion they're going to throw at renewable energy, which is irrelevant to the question of climate change and the melting of the polar ice cap, which is what we are and should be talking about. So that's environment and climate change. In education, how much is going to be free? And is everything going to be free? That's the Sanders position. And people who don't think everything should be free start out with one foot in the hole because they're not promising enough money. I agree with you. That's a trap for the Democrats that they seem to be stepping into. In just in terms of how they're framing their proposals, they're all. How many dollars am I going to throw at this situation?
Without necessarily plausibly explaining how to pay for it. So, Medicare for All and others, this estimate of Elizabeth Warren's plans would require a 124% hike in federal tax revenue. Now, I know that it's fashionable among the Democrats to say they'll get that from the rich and the corporations, but I think you and I know that that's not going to happen. I mean, they're not going to be able to get that much money without going after the middle class. So this is a real concern that you have a lot of people who are really disgusted with Donald Trump who are going to look at those numbers and go, whoa, okay, as horrible as this is, I don't want to bankrupt the country. I don't want to see massive tax increases. I don't want to see some of these other policies that that I think are kind of scary.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And by the way, if those policies are adopted and Medicare for All and all the Democratic promises, you can forget economic growth in this country. That would choke off business expansion immediately. I cut taxes 21 times. I never raised them. I'm a pro-growth guy on economics. And these Dems don't sound like they're pro-growth at all. And one thing the country does appreciate is economic growth because there's no social program that's as good as a job. So I do think Donald Trump can win this election in 2020. I think, as I say, if he spends billions of dollars on Facebook and other ads, he could virtually buy this election. That's another thing that would happen. And he's welcome to try, of course, if he's in office. But if he's removed, that is removed as a threat. And I think we'll have, cleaner, more on top of the table on the merits election with Mr. Trump not participating.
Speaking of ads, any thoughts about Mark Zuckerberg saying that he's concerned about the erosion of truth, but that Facebook is not going to be fact-checking any political ads, so that if Donald Trump wants to spend $10 million in Facebook ads saying that Hillary Clinton and Ukraine were behind the server and the murder of Seth Rich, that he'll basically cash the checks and run the ads?
I don't know. I think it's a slippery slope once you start telling people they have to police political advertising. I'm not with Elizabeth Warren on confiscatory policies towards big tech companies. I kind of let the market sort that all out. Obviously, if it becomes known that Facebook is publishing a lot of completely phony baloney ads just because Trump gave him a big check, they're going to pay a price in the market for that. But I'd rather do that than have the government step in and tell people what to do on the internet or in any other context.
So let's say that the Senate does remove Donald Trump and it's Mike Pence is the Republican nominee. Are you still in the race?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'd rather run against Mike Pence than against Donald Trump, because at least that would mean that Donald Trump wouldn't be there.
Governor Bill Weld, thank you so much for coming back to the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Charlie. Always a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. The episode was brought to you by Simply Safe. We'll be back on Monday morning, and we will do this all over again.